How about a salute tonight to nutty countries of the world, huh? There's a lot of nutty countries around. Of course, I'm not excluding our own, which is somewhat humorous in many aspects. We'd like to salute the nutty country. South Africa has banned the sale of the soft cover edition of the book Nudie Photos, but has okayed the hardcover version. Their reasoning was, and we quote, "The type of person who buys a soft cover edition is more likely to be corrupted." Something's happening to that theme. I mean, if you notice, everything is slowly falling apart. I was walking through Fun City here, you know, a couple of hours ago, knee-deep in... This is absolutely... has to be now, today, in 1970. It has to be the dirtiest city ever that was ever created by man. I don't think New York was actually created by man. I think it just sort of, you know, grew. Who built it? But it's unbelievably dirty. And I as a kid, you know, I'd always heard about the fantastic filth of places like Bombay and all that stuff. Oh, nothing. I've been there, friend. I've been. It ain't got nothing on Fun City. Maybe it's because of all the great people. That reminds me. Baby Jane Holzer, where are you now that America needs you? I repeat, Baby Jane Holzer, where are you now that America needs you? Yeah. Come on, bring it up big. Oh, Baby Jane. Baby Jane. Oh, Baby Jane Holzer, where are you now that America needs you? Needs you, where are you hiding, baby? Oh, Baby Jane, we remember you well. You're the biggest thing since bottled beer back in the 60s in the olden, golden, beautiful days of the 1960s decade. Oh, Baby Jane, oh, Baby Jane, yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, Baby Jane, where are you now when we need you? Oh, Baby Jane, you have gone from the big old USA scene. Oh, 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 Baby Jane. Oh, Baby Jane. Oh, Baby Jane. Holzer. Hold it there. Hold it there. Did I pronounce it right? Holzer? Yeah, okay. Baby Jane Holzer, where are you now that America needs you? Ba-da-da-bum-bum. Oh, boy. Boy, she went the way of the yo-yo and the beanie with the propeller on the top and hula hoops. Oh, Baby Jane. You know, it must be terrible to be a living fad and then have your fad disappear. I mean, it's, you know, a yo-yo lying unwanted down in the basement amid all the old used tires and stuff does not suffer. But to... you know, I can just imagine Baby Jane Holzer, because she has to be around, you know, Baby Jane Holzer going to a party one day, you know, and somebody says, what's your name? Baby Jane. Who? Baby Jane Holzer. Baby Jane Holzer? You mean there really is and was a Baby Jane Holzer? You mean your Baby Jane? So I can bring up, come on, come on, come on. Baby Jane. Better music all the time. I'll tell you. You notice that? bad news, Bill. All right. We got to get straight. Baby Jane Holzer. I'm sorry. Had to give her a salute there. It's not easy, you know, being a fad. I'll tell you. Whatever happened to Marshall McLuhan? You remember poor old Marshall? He was a big television special fella. Whatever happened to Marshall McLuhan? Oh, Marshall McLuhan, where are you now that the world needs you? He's gone the way of Jolting Joe DiMaggio. La-da-da-da. Well, every dog has his day, I'll tell you that. All right, enough of this. I see that New Guinea is starting a fantastic drive to rid itself of giant snails. We'd like to salute New Guinea out there in its fight against evil. Giant snails were introduced by Japanese soldiers in 1942. Oh, them Japs, I'll tell you. The snails damage village gardens and are suspected of eating the coconut palms. The Japanese soldiers use the snails for food. And now the giant snails are all over the place. Weigh 17 pounds, some of them. You put a saddle on them, stirrups, and the whole bit. Of course, you don't go anywhere, but what the hell? There's no place to go in New Guinea anyway. Would you please hit the money button, if you will, Herbert?
Yeah.
Words and music.
What's this
about
guy, son?
Miller.
Oh, Miller! Here.
Words like tall, cold stein. In a quiet corner. Refreshing. Friendly. Words like another Miller for both of us. Real beer words like hearty, robust, deep down good. Cold, thirst quenching, foamy. Words like Miller makes it right. In bottles, cans, and on draft. Words
Miller.
You can never forget.
Highlight.
Like
yeah.
Miller Highlight.
Total cliche. You don't forget
beers.
A cliche.
The champagne of beers. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee.
You know, have you noticed? You see, that commercial is a very interesting example of something. Now, you know, one of the hardest things to do is to think of a word. And, of course, have you noticed that every beer commercial that has ever been written, even about some of the worst beer in the history of Western man, has been described as robust, hearty, and deep down goodness. Every last one, all have deep down goodness. Now, you see, if you go out and get the real writers to write commercials, you wouldn't be stuck with that. Because, you know, has it occurred to you today that writers, that most writers live lives of such limited reality? Because, after all, the writer lives in the world of writers, generally, just like the theater people live lives of theater people. But ultimately, they are not reporting on life. They're reporting on whatever field they're in. And so a writer, when he writes a novel, is really writing a compendium of all the experiences he's experienced by reading all the other guys' novels. Not much to do with life, you know. It's like getting the 15th carbon copy of a fictional letter that was written by a bad writer in the first place. And so, no, seriously, have you ever wondered where in the hell writers get their ideas of life? Well, I know one guy who wrote a play who has never, as far as I know, ever gotten out of a Broadway phone booth. And yes, his whole life is spent in phone booths, running in and out and around, calling agents. And he wrote a play about life, which was really a compendium of all the plays he had seen since he was three. And he knows when people cry, because he's seen Geraldine Page do it so many times, you know? He knows exactly when. He knows what real life is about. Because he's seen Martin Gable in real life so many times. He knows that. He knows what it's about. And he knows good guys. He's seen many a good guy, ranging all the way from Paul Newman to Sidney Poitier. He knows a good guy every time he sees one. And so he naturally had to write a hit play, because he had all the same cliches. And, of course, the theater-goer lives that way, too. Very few theater-goers ever look out of the window. I mean, you know, they spend a little time once in a while in lines at the ticket brokers. By the way, that reminds me, that also happens now today in commercials. And so, you don't find many guys writing commercials that actually sit down and, you know, drink the stuff or drive the thing. A commercial is a compendium of all the other commercials the guy's written. About the same subject. Rape, ripe, rich, deep, and good. Oh, goodness, it goes right down to the goodness. Rich, ripe, and good, and deep, rewarding flavor. And all these words just come out. You say beer, guy immediately turns out. You just boom, boom, you stamp on the beer commercials. Ah! What was this? Help. Help, help. Wait a minute. Help, help, help. There, we're back on. What was this thing here? Is this a John's? You mean he needs all this equipment to put that thing on? How about that? Well, he's really fooling the public. Deep down delicious. Yeah, speaking of deep down delicious, we have a... I like to collect questions and answers from newspapers, you know. These little pleas, these little cries for help that you see in these columns like Ann Landers. Can you imagine? That's true dildockery. That's true dildockery, if I may coin an adjective there. Dildockery is the process of murky thinking that goes through somebody's mind that figures that if he writes to Ann Landers, it'll solve his problem. Now, that takes a dildock.
Well, I'm going to write to Ann Landers. I'll find out why she don't love me.
And the next thing you know, there's seven columns, you know, in the Daily News or the Post or whatever, whatever paper. Dear Dildock, notice you can answer everything. I've noticed that Ann Landers now is an expert on recipes, sex, teenage problems, morality, the Western world, Vietnam, you know, everything. By the way, speaking of universal experts, this is WOR, and we're here in Old Fun City. Indeed. Fun city. Well, well, it's fun. I mean, if you get to roll with a punch, it becomes fun. You know, prize fighters actually get to like fighting, you know, after all. And so it is Fun City, if you look at it that way. The deep streak. This is the city for masochists. If you're a masochist, come to New York. You'll have more fun. I'll tell you, the eighth time your apartment's broken into and you're mugged and, you know, get... couple little wingers like that, you're going to have more fun than you ever found in Chillicothe. Would you please hit the ding-dong again, please? Hit the... This is a loud one. Hit it there. Come on, let's go. Let's go, Herbie. Come on. Come on, Herbie. Brave, be brave. Come on. That's it. Face right up to it. Herb, so fastidious.
Case in point, Impala. America's bestseller and best saver.
Case
a big luxury Impala costs you less than 13 of the smaller mid-size cars.
What
you
is a smaller mid-size
you
car?
Get
now, there's
ride,
a little dildockery.
Big room, big go.
A smaller mid-size car, a fraction of the compact, a little of the big ones. Yes, sir.
And in Impala, you get that GM solid body and looks which keep you way ahead.
First is the first burr, 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 burr. Of the Impala, Impala. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Chance, America's romance. Yeah. The Chevrolet is going hot and heavy.
A big luxury Impala for less than 13 mid-size cars.
Gas, gas, to keep your bill full fat. And get in the Chevrolet.
Impala. A big luxury for less than 13 mid-size cars. Your New Jersey Chevrolet dealer is where it's at.
Yeah. Impala.
Impala is just like the Whippet. There's nothing wrong with a Whippet. That's an animal, too. For a long time, they've been naming cars after animals. Why don't they name after some real groovy animals, like the shark? Of course, they did. Have Mako? Mako shark? Yeah. What happened to that? People didn't know what a Mako was. See? They figured they thought it said make out, and then that confused everybody, and they had to change that when, you know, little old ladies get mad. But I can think of some great names you can name cars after, though. The crocodile. Let's see. The splariated gas eater. Yeah, the dog. I'm sorry. That was bad news. By the way, we'd like to, tonight, if I may, salute one of those poor letter writers. Question. When the doctor put our little terrier Nosy on a diet, did you read this one? I agreed to go along. The doctor said it might be a case of life or death, and that scared my wife. to where she agreed to do it. I went along without knowing what I was letting myself in for. That was 3 weeks ago. Since then, I have not had one home-cooked meal. I get a cold breakfast before I go to work. Then at night, we always go out to eat so Nosey won't feel bad because he won't smell food cooking. We go out at night to eat. Oh, isn't that cute? Nosey doesn't feel too bad, but I feel terrible. She has lost 2 pounds, and that's good. But I have gained 4 pounds on rotten restaurant cooking, and I don't feel so good. And my wife's insulted because I gained weight on restaurant food and don't on hers, and that's bad. What I want to know is there any way to get Nosey to lose weight faster? Yeah. I know one way. What's with the people? They're, you know, it's getting out of hand. By the way, we'd like to salute, speaking of things getting out of hand, I have it here. Just a minute. It's getting out of hand. The little note says, I was looking over my new copy of the 1970 World Almanac, and I saw a list of the name Tiny Tim. Well, he's contributed a lot to the world. It says, but I saw no Walter Kiernan. Well, probably won't find out a lot of other great people listed. Tiny Tim in the World Almanac. Well, that's all right. He's a world figure, of course. Yes, here we are. No, I don't want to tell that story. It's a bad story. Children listening, you know, kids. While we're on the subject of stories, we have with us Rosetta today. That's a commercial. So you can start your commercial tape recording out there, kid. This is a Rosetta commercial. And Rosetta's that stalwart electrical company. And according to their somewhat illiterate copy, Rosetta Electric Company is New York's most unique electrical supermarkets. Now, that's not my words. I will say they are unique, but I won't say they are most unique. They feature the latest in lamps and lighting fixtures and the largest selection of everything from lock nooks to burglar alarms. And you can find them, special for Shepherd listeners. Buy one psychedelic poster, get second one for half price when you give the password. Now, they didn't give me the password. Oh, I don't have the password, no. I do not have the password. It says Rosetta. The same Rosetta that you've all loved and honored throughout the years is at 75 West 45th Street, 79 Chambers Street, and the new Rosetta at 73 Murray Street, 2 blocks west of City Hall, and all of them offer free parking. Free parking on 45th Street? Are you out of your bird? What's the matter with you? You ought to try. I wonder, you know, they just say free parking. Have you ever asked for free parking at any of these places that offer free parking? I guess that's the way it is. Nobody ever actually asks. It's a nice thing to put in a commercial of. Stop in front of the store on 45th Street once, you know, in the middle of rush hour, and rush in and say, I want free parking, quick. I'll buy a light bulb. Oh, that's terrible. I shouldn't do that. That's bad news. Rosetta, my Rosetta. Oh, I was going to tell you a story. I've been kind of shilly-shallying here to, didn't want to get right to the point because it's been bothering me a great deal. This business of fad people. I was thinking about Baby Jane Holzer the other day. I'm sitting in the... maybe you don't remember Baby Jane Holzer. Wait a minute. You say you do, but you'd be surprised at the number of people who do not remember last Wednesday, my dear. In fact, that's part of the now people. I mean, the whole syndrome. Incidentally, are you a now people out there, friend? No, I'm asking a serious question. Don't just nod your head. No. What do you mean, no? You got to say you're a now people. Are you a now people? I mean, are you one of the now people? You aren't? Well, where the hell do I find one? I want to talk to one. Is there a now person out there? Oh, yeah, 18. Yeah, I'm a now people. Yeah. But you see, the most distinctive characteristic of a now person is, for a now person, there was never a yesterday. Never. Yesterday, it happened to other people. And I'm sure that a lot of now people right now are pretending loudly they don't remember who Baby Jane Holzer is. And she was one of the big people of the 60s. Oh, yeah, she's going to go down. when they write the... and already they're writing the history of that somewhat nutty decade. And a Baby Jane will be one of the raisins in the fruit pie. And I think that... that was not a bad phrase, was it? I think that another one... I can think of others that are now people. That is, who were people of the 60s who will be rarely mentioned in the 70s. There's Marshall McLuhan. He'll be referred to for maybe a couple of years. And then by the mid-70s, you won't hear much about McLuhan anymore. And, of course, already Baby Jane Holzer, people think that, she was some chick that ran a hamburger joint down on 4th Avenue. But actually, Baby Jane was one of the phenomena of the period. Another one was, and I predict is already on the way out, is Susan Sontag. That was another one of those nutty momentary things, and lost and gone forever. Other people of the 60s that are already there's a kind of aura, a kind of vague mauve aura of a Valentine past already about it. How many of you remember? Speaking of Valentine past, what was his name? Already I've forgotten. It's terrible. Oh, sure, these people come and go like mad. Andy Warhol is another one of the people of that period that already has a kind of fustian quality about them. Of course, these people were already gaining that late. See, I don't think there's any... I don't think... No, that's not true. Namath was a person of the 60s, and he'll possibly persist a bit into the early 70s, but nevertheless, he was a phenomenon of the 60s, you'd have to say that. The thing about moving into a new decade, see, I don't think things, they really don't, and yet they do, in a curious way, change abruptly with the changing of a decade. Because I think what happens with a decade, and see whether you agree with this, Herb, what happens when we change, when we stop writing 1960 blank on a check and start writing 1970 blank or 1980 blank, the minute we move into a decade, people become exceedingly conscious of the passing of time for a brief period. As you know, right now, there's thousands of magazines on the stands that are all the decade ahead, the decade past. This will persist till about, the middle of 1970, perhaps even early 71. And then we'll fall into the routine of just, it's just a year, just another time. And people become very conscious of this thing. Now, what happens when they become conscious? Well, they suddenly start looking at all the things which they've taken for granted. And quite conceivably, they suddenly turn and say, whatever happened to? Now, in short, they become aware of things which have been sort of part of their lives, which have gradually slipped out, but they haven't noticed it, because most people don't think much about the passage of time. I think that one of the rarest of all qualities that a man has is the time sense. F. Scott Fitzgerald had the time sense, whereas, Hemingway didn't, and which was one of the great differences in their writing. And so, in the early 1930s, Fitzgerald wrote some magnificent short stories about the sudden, abrupt end of a world that ended in the beginning of the Depression, the end of the 1920s. He wrote some fantastic short stories, but some of the best stuff that's ever been written on that feeling, that feeling of the passage of time, was written by Fitzgerald. Whereas Hemingway, on the other hand, kept writing well into the 30s as if everybody was just back from World War I. He did. He kept writing romantic stories of expatriates who were constantly searching in the Spanish mountains for their lost artillery battalion. And it went on and on and on. And so his writing tends to get exceedingly, curiously dated almost instantly while he wrote it. And that was because Hemingway had very little sense of time, I think, personally. Now, most people don't. Most people wake up one day and are astounded to find that it's 1970. Because they're not aware of the passage of time. Now, it can be a good thing. It can be a bad thing to have this sense of time passing. Some people get obsessed with it. Other people look upon it as one of the elements that man lives with. In short, it's like the air. It's like the earth. It's like the environment. You know, we're all very conscious of the environment today. Everybody suddenly is now aware of soil. Well, I can remember a long time ago talking about stuff like that on the air, and people think I'm some kind of a kook. What do you mean? Who's going to worry about beer cans? And because most people, when I began to talk about this, were definitely involved in suburban life. They were only interested in life urban life. They were only interested in the urban world. And now, within the past 5 or 6 years, people have suddenly discovered the outdoors. Have you noticed that the sudden knowledge and awareness of and concern over the environment parallels the growth of, say, camping and campers? And I think they're not unrelated. I think that people leaving their miserable little apartment in Yonkers or their little three-room flat on Flatbush Avenue and going out for the first time in their lives, really going out, then suddenly they're aware of something which they had never even thought about before. They're aware of the contamination of the world that we live in. And by the way, there was a beautiful piece a week or so ago in the Times by Philip Wiley, who has been yelling about the contamination of the world for probably the last 20 years, and nobody's been listening. He's been writing about far more important stuff than, say, the somewhat trivial and somewhat impermanent civil rights issues, which are important to the people that are involved. But after all, the destruction of the world destroys civil rights activists and slobs and squares and everybody all together. In other words, it's a little more deep than the trivial things. And I think Wiley, you're going to see a growth of interest in Philip Wiley in the 1970s. I'm making a prediction. Now, a lot of you don't even know who Wiley was and is. But he's been writing about this stuff for a long time. And now the time has come for people to listen. So I think that Wiley's time, curiously enough, will begin. Wiley's one of those writers who's constantly ahead of his time. When he wrote Generation of Vipers, he preceded Philip Roth by a long time. And when he wrote this, it was just considered some kind of a crotchety nut. And he was well ahead of the guys with the mother hang-up. And many writers have this mother hang-up as galloping. And I think that in the 70s, that's going to suddenly die. I think it's already dying. Ho-hum, another ethnic novel about mother, you know, and her homosexual son. Ho-hum. And yes, it's. I think it's going to abruptly, the bottom is going to go abruptly out of that market. And there's going to be a vast ho-hum every time some guy writes a thing about how he suddenly fell in love with his friend Billy. And it was because of his mother. And this is going to become the vast ho-hum. And people are going to look back on that genre of novel, the way they look back today on Eleanor Wiley of the 20s, kind of a sad romantic, but has very little relevance to the time that we live in. That will be the big ho-hum of the forthcoming time, because there's bigger issues now than whether or not we accept homosexuals or don't accept them and so forth. There's much bigger issues. And among them, of course, is the fact that we're all able to die of just one day breathing in the purple death or something that'll come sneaking in out of the Jersey Meadows. But did you read that piece in the Times? A beautiful piece about the Everglades. And written by Philip Wiley. I happen to know something about the Everglades, and I've spent a lot of time in the Glades, and I love the Everglades. I think the Everglades are one of the most exciting places in the entire country. And my own personal feeling is that it would have been a major crime against the future and a major crime against us had we allowed a gigantic jet port to be paved over, to pave over this whole magnificent place. which I think is. And by the way, Wiley's articles go far further afield than simply saying, gee, we should preserve the birds or we should preserve bird watching. What he says is that there's a lot of things we don't know about ecology. And in other words, the life support systems that keep us alive, we could very well destroy without even knowing that we do. You see, ecology, you know what ecology is, Chris. This is another thing that I remember several years back talking about ecological problems on the show, and people writing and saying, why don't you talk about the real stuff, like the Newark riots or something like that? Well, actually, I think the Newark riots, a lot of things come out of ecological problems. I think that many of our civil rights problems come out of ecological basis when they're ultimately followed to their last logical and illogical conclusions. Now, what is ecology? Well, for those of you who may, for one reason or another, not be familiar with the term, and I'm not putting it down, it's a very easily, you know, it's easy not to be familiar with it. Ecology really is the study of life support systems as opposed to the study of life. In short, what is it that makes a turtle live? What in some places, and he can't live in the other place. What are the very involved, very subtle, and delicate traceries of existence that make a turtle possible in certain places and not in others? And we see problems of ecology everywhere. It's like if you eliminate one creature, like say if you were to go out and kill all the rabbits, well, what happens then? What do rabbits live on? What were rabbits keeping in check? What kind of food were the rabbits providing? What did they do to the land? Was it important that a rabbit be living here? And if you kill all the rabbits, what happens? On the other hand, if you kill a certain kind of bird, one of the most famous cases, of course, of all, is the case of the rabbit in Australia. When the natural enemy of the rabbit was destroyed by hunters and so forth, it wound up that the rabbits overran everything and wound up destroying practically all the crops. It was a playing around with the system, you see. Now, if man destroys things without thinking in terms of the future, he could very well be destroying his own future, not knowing it, innocently doing it. And, of course, a lot of people only think that incidentally is connected with the sense of time. Again, most people have no sense of time. And if you say to a guy, look, friend, if you do this thing today, you realize, of course, that 20 years from now, the world is going to come tumbling down. He has no concept. What do you mean? Most people really actually refuse to believe that 20 years will pass. For some reason or other, it is always today to many people. And they it's very hard for them to conceive of the idea that it will be 1990. Now, you may not be around to see it, but it will be 1990 one day. Now, if you are around to see 1990, you will be astounded to notice that a lot of the things that people were yelling about in 1970 came to pass. And you, again, having no sense of time, will cleverly forget that you were warned about them in 1970. Now, many of the people that are running around yapping loudly about ecology are the very people that 10 years ago put anybody down who mentioned it. I'll guarantee you that, and I know several myself, because they have this now feeling. They're jumping on the now issue. Now, they don't know they do this. The very people that were responsible for this kind of stuff are the very people that are going to be yelling bloody murder about... it's just a curious thing about it. I've seen them do it. And you try to remind them, well, wait a minute now. I remember 9 years ago, you were responsible in bringing the giant insect repellent plant to Pitcairn, New Jersey. You were saying how great it would be for the people there. Now all the people in the ghetto would have a place to work and all that. Now you're mad because this company is dumping all the crud in the river and everybody's dying, most of all in the ghetto. What about it? What do you mean? What do you mean? I had nothing to do. We are very convenient about our time sense. And so, I'm sorry I got on the subject, but I'm very involved personally, as we all should be. I think this is a subject that mankind really can unite on. And I've always felt that, well, of course, one of the oldest stories, one of the oldest plots in science fiction or fantasy fiction is the invasion from an external source that unites mankind for the first time. This is an old plot. Well, I think it's happening. I think we are being invaded, but the curious thing about it is that we are invading ourselves. In other words, the invasion from outer space is actually that. If you know much about smog, and if you know much about fallout, if you know much about the pollutants that are in the air, they really are from outer space, curiously enough. And we, in a sense, it's like the centipede that eats its own tail, or the dog that chases its own tail. We are our own invader, which makes it even harder to fight. When you're invading yourself, you never recognize it until often it's too late. There was an old, what was the old Chinese, there was an old Chinese myth about a crocodile that saw this movement in the bushes, and the crocodile attacked it, and he recognized it, and there was a tremendous feeling of pain he had upon this moment of attack, and then he realized that whatever it was attacking back, so he attacked even harder. And so he wound up by eating himself up to the stomach. And that was the end of the ball game. Which, this is one of those old Oriental canards, but it's very true. Most of them are true. And yet, unfortunately, often they contradict another Oriental canard. However, in the case of this one, there is a great deal of truth, because I believe that we are invading ourselves. And I believe that the invasion is one of such vast and subtle, nature, that most people are unaware of the invasion. That most people are not, all they know is that their eyes hurt. You know that today in New York City, one of the biggest, and it's gone on almost unnoticed. You know, one of the biggest businesses today in New York City is the eye doctor. It is fantastic. Just a few years ago, you could go to an eye doctor, and there'd be two or three people waiting, and like a couple old people, you know, having glasses fitted in that. Now, go to any place, particularly in Midtown, and there's like 500 people waiting. When you come in, you have to take a little slip, like in the A&P. Have you seen that, Herb? You take a slip, you know, you're number 28 in line, see, and you take the slip, and so they call your number out. And this is all because of invasion of the atmosphere, or a lot of it is. Not all of it, of course, but a great deal of it is a result of this problem. Now, you know that respiratory diseases, for example, are on a tremendous galloping increase. And if you don't think so, try to get yourself an appointment with a doctor that specializes in it. You'll find you also have to take a slip when you walk in. Now, we all know that this is the most obvious thing, but there's been a slow creeping increase in a very interesting disease that has gone largely unrecorded. Everybody's running around yelling about cancer, which, by the way, grew, and that many people feel, is directly, or possibly, let's put it this way, indirectly connected with the problems of pollution of the atmosphere and pollution of our world. That could very well be that the thing that's been eluding people in this cancer struggle is the fact that we might very well have, you know, cancer. Now, let's go into that. You know, that most doctors are convinced, of course, that the cancer was a very rare disease before 1900, comparatively. Did you know that? It was. We sort of think it was always around. It wasn't. That cancer was a comparatively rare, Other diseases killed people far more often than cancer killed people up to about 1900. The most common disease, of course, that killed people before 1900 was pneumonia. Pneumonia was a great killer before 1900, as well as tuberculosis was another great killer before 1900. Now, both of these diseases were closely allied with problems of nutrition and so forth, that undernourished people quite often are very prone to problems like TB. But after 1900, there was a sudden and inexplicable rise in cancer deaths, largely lung cancer, or cancerous conditions of the throat, larynx, and so forth. Well, it was easy enough to say it was cigarettes, you know, period. But now they're beginning to see that the problem was far more complex than that, and many people are suffering from another new sinister disease, curiously, which has gone largely unnoticed, and that's emphysema, which has grown tremendously in the past 8 or 9 years, the number of cases that are detected throughout, particularly in urban areas. Well, what is emphysema? Well, this is an eventually fatal disease of the lungs. It's from breathing in crud day and night, 24 hours a day, for a certain number of years, and the next thing you know, the breathing mechanism stops working, period. You've been gassed, is what it amounts to. It's a slow process of gassing. of course, there's a little more. I'm going to get a lot of letters from doctors. There's a little more to it than that. But this, in very rough form, is what happens in many cases. Now, it's all right to get all excited over whether or not the dean is nice to girls in the undergraduate school. It's all right to throw yourself into nice little comfortable trivial issues, I think, ultimately trivial. But I think in the 1970s, you're going to see a tremendous growth of interest in the atmosphere and the environment that we live in. I found one of the most interesting men I've ever known was an ecologist, and I knew him a long time ago at the University of Cincinnati. When he was teaching ecology, there were about three people coming in to take his courses every year. He was some kind of a nut that worried about birds. I mean, he went around and yelled about the fact that the mud minnows were dying in Little Miami Creek, and that nobody cared where. Then who cares about a mud minnow? Well, actually, he says, what do you mean? We're the next mud minnow, friend. And nobody worried. But now they are very worried, and it could very well be, and some ecologists feel this, it could very well be that we're becoming interested in it too late. There is one field of science that feels very strongly, one group of scientists. Of course, there's always one group of scientists that look at everything from a totally negative attitude. One group of scientists feel that we are getting interested in this thing like about 25 years after the horse has been copped, you know, after somebody's galloped out with old Fred. Well, maybe. I don't know. On the other hand, I'm firmly convinced that a large part of the population is not even today aware of the problem. They don't know why they're bugged. You know, how many of you feel, I wonder if alienation, the so-called phenomena of the 60s, you know, when people felt lonely and alienated, I wonder what this has done to our psyche, unknowingly. I mean, the subtle gases that are floating around. I think that there's so much we don't even know about this problem of ecology that quite conceivably much of what we thought was human in nature, in other words, human nature coming out, could actually have been the result of an organism reacting both psychically and physiologically against the imbalance of its ecological life system. Curious, just wondering. In other words, would Portnoy's complaint have been written had there not been a steady, slow, purple-green haze drifting in from the Jersey marshlands out over Yonkers and out over Queens and the Bronx? Would Portnoy have turned out to be Portnoy? I don't know. And I don't think Roth does either. Hang loose. Baby Jane Holzer, wherever you are, you'll come back, baby.
This is Peter Roberts.